Okay, Chris Masterjohn, Generative Energy. That was a lot of troubleshooting and a failure on my part. How are you, Chris?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Danny?
Good, man. It's been since 2011.
Yeah. That was a while ago.
Yeah, that was a little bit ago. So
world's a different place. Yeah.
You think so? Do you think so?
It's the same place and a different place.
Yeah.
Depends on your perspective.
Okay, well, I actually wanted to start there, as long ago as that seems. Like, I remember co-opting you when you were walking to one of the, was that UCI? What school was that at?
Well, it was AHS, right?
Yeah, AHS 11.
Probably UCSF, but I'm not sure.
Anyways, I remember co-opting you in like
UCLA, maybe.
Yeah, UCLA, I think that was it. And talking to you about repeat. And I think we were specifically talking about fructose. And I was like, Do you think he's right about fructose? And do you think he's wrong? you had like the most like intricate explanation that it was like, like right over my head, because I was pretty much.
Sorry about that.
No, that's not your fault. I think that was just your high intellect and my way less subpar intellect trying to connect at that time. But
I think that might have been the year where Robert Lustig was in the elevator with me, and he seemed scared of me when he said hi.
I actually have a lot of funny stories from that, but I can't remember who was giving a presentation. It might have been Stefan Guillene, but Lustig had fallen asleep in the crowd, and then Denise Wigger was sitting next to me, and we were like taking photos of Lustig, and then like creative, like putting cats on them, like after, like it was just like a vivid like image of Lustig. But and then I also remember
was that the year that Gary Taubes got in a fight with Stefan?
Well, it had to have been, because I was there and I only went 1 year. And then the other outstanding memory that I actually have from there is during your talk, Jack Cruz asking like an incomprehensible question to you. Do you remember that?
No, but that sounds on character for him.
I remember because my buddy was like, "Do you know who that is? That's like a neurosurgeon, Jack Cruz." And I was like, "I have no clue who that is." And then he was sitting in the back, and I swear to God, he had like a undershirt on with like a barbecue stain on his shirt. And he stood up to ask you a question. And I remember you just being like totally like perplexed at, it was like something about like quantum biology. And it was not even in the realm of what you were talking about. It was bizarre, like a completely bizarre experience.
So me and Cruz were both invited to this conference in Vermont, way smaller conference that no one really knows about. And he was talking about vitamin A in his talk, and he's like, "Vitamin A doesn't do what Chris Masterjohn says it does. It's like, it's created out of nowhere, the eye from light." I'm like, all right.
Okay. Whatever. Enough here. Was that after or before your presentation, or did he was like given?
I don't remember. I was less impressed that he mentioned me, and more just thought it was crazy what he was saying, but
I was impressed with the barbecue scene on his t-shirt. It was really,
really... No, I don't remember that at all.
Yeah, man, that feels like, it was like a lifetime ago. Yeah. Okay. So trying to figure out where I want to go.
Have beards now.
We do. We both have, give up on life beards, or Ted Kaczynski beards is what I call it. Okay, I want to talk to you about the COVID stuff, because I feel like, in at least from my perception, I think a lot of people in the health world were not critical of what was going on, or they were critical and not saying anything because they wanted to protect whatever they had online. And so I think the few times I checked in with you, I you were always sticking to your guns, saying, "Hey, I mean, later on in the whole thing, what's happening is wrong. And I'm about like body autonomy first before I am about any of these health ideas." And so maybe going back to 2020 or March of 2020, and given your perspective of then and now, like what did you think then, and how do you think about it now?
Well, going We got to go back a little bit further because I actually had my first case of COVID in the end of January 2020. And first day of symptoms was February 1st, 2020. So I probably got infected end of January. I was aware of it in two ways before most people were. One was because I was listening to the New York Times Daily podcast at the time, and they were covering it when it was some mysterious disease that people were trying to raise the government's attention to in China, and the government was covering it up. And then also I follow Tim Ferriss, and Tim Ferriss had jumped on it very early on. And I remember one of the first things that I heard about it was Sam Harris talking about how he had a friend who was completely healthy, fit, 30-year-old male and died of it. So my first instinct was to be pretty afraid of it. You know, I didn't know what it was. And there were people who I really trusted about health or infectious disease, but who I just, you know, considered in my trustable circle who, you know, never before had been freaking out about some virus. And so it, you know, caught my attention as likely to be different from most other viruses I had, you know, come into contact with. I think the first sign that something was deeply wrong was when I was watching Cuomo's press conference. Andrew Cuomo is the governor of New York at the time. And he stated what I now call the Cuomo test, which is if it would save one life, we must shut the whole city down. And not only him saying that, but none of the journalists pushing back in any way made it pretty obvious that rationality had been thrown out the window. You know, it's one thing to say, we are not sure what this is. Let's shut this conference down until we learn more about it, because if it's bad, we don't want it to super spread. It's another thing to introduce a principle that if you could save one life, you have to shut the whole city down. I mean, it's just obvious that that's false, because one life could be saved by abolishing traffic, like abolish cars. You would save many lives, but no one's abolishing cars. You know, any number of causes of death that are allowed to run rampant in the city, you can. I mean, just a few years before that, in 2015, they got rid of stop and frisk, which was a completely unconstitutional search and seizure that was racially targeted and whatever. But when they got rid of stop and frisk that year, the year to date murder rate in my neighborhood went up 700%.
Wow.
And there was someone being shot in my precinct every single day in summer of 2015 until they started until the NYPD and the feds took down the outlaw gangsta Crips in East Flatbush.
Wow.
So anyway, it's completely obvious that they don't believe that if you could save one life, you can take any measure, right?
Yeah, like, they're so obsessed with retaining life. Like these people, these whores for industry and stuff of proliferating new dangerous technologies and things, they can't let one person die, you know? Yeah, it's so absurd.
Yeah, well, it later turned out that Cuomo didn't shut the city down to save grandma. He killed grandma so he could shut the city down. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I don't think I was privy to this as it was happening, but as the more I became skeptical, the more I looked into it and realized that Cuomo had in March 2020 made an executive order that none of the infected people coming out of the hospital who were in nursing homes could be rejected from the nursing homes, even if they were still infectious. Mm-hmm. And he ordered them into the nursing homes. And then on top of that, he snuck into the budget bill immunity for the nursing home executives. And then he, by executive order, stopped counting the number of COVID deaths that occurred in nursing homes. So this guy created the pandemic. I mean, if you think about it, but going, and I suspect that the reason that Cuomo was basically fired by Joe Biden I mean, Cuomo was under impeachment hearings for impeachment investigation by the state Senate for a long time until the day that Joe Biden told him to resign over the sexual harassment scandal, and the impeachment investigation stopped the day after that. And I believe that's because what the impeachment investigation would probably have uncovered is corruption going up at least to the CDC, where Cuomo was probably advised by people over him at the national level to do that. Mm-hmm. The only other state that had an outbreak at that time was in Washington State, I think it was, where the CDC ordered the nursing homes to stop testing. They said, you're not allowed to test anyone for COVID until we approve a test. And then they dragged their feet and took forever to approve a test. So what did they do? They basically seeded the pandemic through the nursing homes, killing off as many old people as they could. And then, all the people who work in the nursing homes and then come back to normal life, then spread it like wildfire in the city. So they probably could have contained it if it wasn't their goal to spread it. But they spread it and they made it look outrageously more fatal than it was by killing off the old people first. If you look at the second, the first, second, and third wave of COVID, if you just go to Google and type in the COVID cases and the COVID deaths and divide the COVID deaths by the COVID cases to get the fatality rate, the infection fatality rate is 8 times higher in the first wave than the second wave, and 15 times higher in the first wave than the third wave, right? Why was it so high? Part of it is you would expect that because the people most vulnerable die off and leave the less vulnerable people behind, but I think it's eightfold because they just straight up killed all the most vulnerable people. And then they could come up with this absurd test to make it sound rational that if you could save one life, you shut the whole city down. So another turning point for me was when like half my family had kind of gotten caught up in the, oh yeah, we shouldn't see each other for Thanksgiving and whatever. And the other half kind of didn't get caught up in that. And I have a very small nuclear fam, it's like me and my mom. And then I have a huge extended family with lots of cousins. So Thanksgiving 2020, I went to Thanksgiving. I was in the half that decided Thanksgiving was okay. And I had my aunt and my cousin came up from Florida. And it was so obvious to me at that time that those two people were so much happier than everyone else. And then at that point, it suddenly struck me that I didn't realize how much anxiety and depression and psychological distress was happening to me and everyone else in the Northeast until I saw people from Florida who were just, seemed like they weren't in 2020. They were in the previous world. And so that was a turning point for me I was starting to realize it as soon as Cuomo made the Cuomo test, but then I was like, it really hit home for me. Like, wow, I can't believe now I realize how much this is affecting me. And then the vaccine stuff was the major turning point because I spent all of 2020 or most of it doing like 12 hours a day of research on filtering through the 200 titles that came out on the preprint servers of COVID research, figuring out which ones were worth reading, and then figuring out which ones were worth writing about in my newsletter, and then doing that, right? So all of 2020, I'm spending completely immersed in all the many things that you can do to protect yourself from COVID. And then when the vaccine stuff comes out, I just keep on doing what I've been doing the whole time, which is I read some research, I write about it. And then all of a sudden I'm getting people who are like, it's your fault that there are mass graves in Mexico because you are discouraging people from getting the vaccine. But I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm just like reading research and posting the research about it. And so the way that people had got caught up in this religious fervor, the vaccine became a substitute for a Christian baptism, where it was the one thing that you must do for the remission of all sins. I mean, there was even in New Orleans, they didn't explicitly make a quid pro quo where if you get vaccinated, you get your felony wiped off your record. Mm-hmm. But they did say, come get your felony wiped off your record. If you're vaccinated, we'll help you fill out the paperwork.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
And so there, when I read that, I was like, this is literally the remission of sins promised by the theistic authority to the sinners, right? Like, what the hell does this have to do with science? This is religion, you know? And then of course, when it got to the point, like when I got kicked out of my gym because I didn't have the COVID vaccine, I got like a squat rack and all this other equipment in the room next to me, because within 3 days I had my home gym put together. But when they started threatening tens of thousands of people to lose their jobs over it, that's when I really got involved in the activism around the vaccine mandates. And there was a period of time where some of my friends and I had this underground secret Google Maps list where we would go into the restaurants and see who would reliably not check our papers and then would add the restaurant to the list. And so it had a little bit of an appeal.
Speakeasy.
Of being like a mini, we're not like Edward Snowden or something, but we're like, kind of on that scale or whatever, in a small way. And then it was, I think the vaccine mandates for the restaurants in New York City, they ultimately got defeated by sit-ins. So there was just around the time that there was so much national attention focused on the sit-ins at Cheesecake Factory, where the cops would come and arrest five people, and it was happening where, like, when on the day that Cheesecake Factory event happened, the day after it, there was a small army of police officers who had come to Cheesecake Factory preemptively. There's like 30 of them in the hallway at Cheesecake Factory to protect Cheesecake Factory from the potential of another unvaccinated five people that want to sit down at their table. And this is the same day where, like, someone died because someone pushed them in front of the train.
Yeah.
And no one was there to stop it. And then, they watch this dude who wants to kill everyone who's not black. He comes from way out of state, documents his trip on YouTube. The FBI had been watching this guy for a while, decided he wasn't a threat. He documents his whole trip in real time on YouTube. There's video of him yelling at racial epithets at like Hispanic people, mm-hmm. for being like too white proximate, and Chinese people for being like, high up in society because of the white privilege that's donated to them. And he says that they should die on camera. And the guy shows up in, on a day that the cameras mysteriously went blank in the subway, he shows up, throws a smoke bomb and starts randomly shooting at people. Mm-hmm. And so these videos, they made, like, there was someone I knew who was, she had been a nobody. She was, worked in the school system. She was at every protest printing out subversive stickers, asking donations for them that people could put up. And this girl gets 20 seconds on Jimmy Fallon talking about how they need to take down Cheesecake Factory, because Fallon's just making fun of these idiots in New York who are so intent on killing grandma that they're willing to eat at Cheesecake Factory and spread a disease, right? Like, he's making fun of them, but still, it's national attention all over the place like that, juxtaposed against the people dying from being pushed in front of the train or being shot up in the subway system, and all the cops are at Cheesecake Factory. And I think the credibility loss was being squeezed so to the maximum at that point that they just quietly got rid of all these mandates. And it took 6 months for them to get rid of the worker mandates and stuff like that. And now people are winning court cases and whatever, but that's sort of the story of my evolution. And on that,
I completely forgot about that shooter. Like, that's, That's like, so that seems like it was 10 years ago or something that like, I wouldn't even have remembered if you hadn't told me.
It was less than a year ago.
Dude, wild. I can't remember when I thought that there would definitely be a new vaccine that came out. I mean, it might have been pretty early on. I think people were talking about that in April, saying this is all going to lead to a new vaccine coming out. What is your history with vaccines? Have you been skeptical of them? Have you been would you have a reason to be skeptical of them before you found out about the COVID vaccine? And then once you found out the mechanism of the vaccine, were you like, this sounds nuts? Or what did you think about that?
Well, I did know that there was almost no one anywhere who ever had any rational conversations about vaccines, and all vaccine advocates spoke as if with a religious attitude towards them. But I didn't have any decisions that I would make about the ultimate efficacy. So it was a topic that until COVID, I had decided I was going to table until I had children, because I was vaccinated for everything on the schedule in the 1980s. And I am like 20 or 30 years behind in my tetanus shot, but I can't find any evidence that the tetanus boosters are needed even by standard. You can find papers suggesting that because not every country has every 10 year boosters, mm-hmm. and there's like no difference in the incidence of tetanus between those that do and those that don't. I also know that like you're not going to get a tetanus infection if you like pour some hydrogen peroxide into a deep wound, because the reason you get it in the first place is because it grows in anoxic environments. And so if the wound is deep enough that the tissue starts to close up before the immune system can kill what's there, then the oxygen level is too low in the wound. And it's I'm not worried about it, but anyway, I did know that people believe things that are obviously false about vaccines as the main things that they believe about vaccines. So, I was watching Lex Fridman, I think it was in the intro to his interview with the Pfizer CEO, and he makes a statement, vaccines have saved hundreds of millions of lives or whatever. And I'm like, you're making a lot of shortcuts in your thinking, because all of the vaccine preventable diseases had their mortality wiped out before the vaccines for them were made. Is this the right book? I thought I had the book there. Anyway, Thomas McKeown's The Modern Rise in Population from 1976 is the best starting place for this, because he was not trying to you might find some charts in there from the book. I'm not sure. He was not trying to argue that against vaccines. In fact, he shows this graph of tuberculosis mortality going down, like almost disappearing until they introduced the vaccine in the UK. And then the last little bit of mortality disappears after the vaccine is introduced. And he speaks positively of the vaccine and says that it probably got rid of, probably sped up the rest of the decrease in mortality. So he's never talking against vaccines. He's just arguing for an alternative hypothesis of why the population exploded. And he's arguing that the nutrition was very bad at the time of very high infectious diseases in like the 1700s and 1800s. And that mortality was wiped out by improvements in nutrition before any of the other things that it is attributed to had the chance to start acting on it. And I would add things to his argument, but the obvious thing here, and he does believe that the smallpox vaccine helped get rid of smallpox mortality, but he argues that smallpox mortality was a very small proportion of infectious disease mortality at the time period when infectious disease mortality went from being the leading cause of death to a trivial cause of death. And so he's not against the idea that the vaccine could wipe out the mortality. It's just that measles became mostly non-fatal by the time the vaccine was introduced. So you can't say that by wiping out all the cases of measles, it wiped out all that mortality, because that though all that measles was not potential mortality at the time the vaccine was introduced. And so, you know, it may be the case that you could argue that somewhere in the developing world, there are countries where measles mortality was legitimately wiped out by the vaccine. I don't know if that's true, but it's absolutely not true in the UK, and it's absolutely not true in the US, and it's absolutely not true for any of the vaccine preventable diseases in the United, in the modern West. And so the fact that people just, they just skip straight to this and they cannot tolerate a challenge to it. Like I posted a graph of tuberculosis and measles mortality years ago, way before COVID, on my Facebook. And I, you know, I just thought it was an interesting graph. Like, wow, look at this. I had never looked at this before. Like, obviously the vaccine didn't wipe out the mortality. And people shoot back with why the this graph is misleading, because the incidence of measles remained high until the vaccine came and wiped it out. And it's like, yes, this is true, but that's just an additional fact to the fact that the vaccine had no impact on measles mortality in any meaningful sense, because it wasn't fatal by the time it wiped out the incidence. So nutrition had rendered measles a largely harmless disease. And modern medicine has also rendered measles a largely harmless disease, even in malnourished people. Like, no one's dying in these measles outbreaks that occur in upstate New York, because modern medicine is able to treat most of the complications of the disease, even if these people are not getting what I would consider optimal nutrition. You know, so I, since COVID has made me realize how much of a scam all modern vaccine efficacy research is, however. So one of the things that kept coming up in the COVID vaccines is this thing called a test negative case control study. And like, what is this? So I go and look at it and I see they define this as all of the cases and the controls have the identical clinical case. And then you test efficacy of the vaccine by the vaccine preventing a positive test for the pathogen of interest. Okay, why would you? So what this means is everyone is equally sick, and you are defining the vaccine as effective based on a test. In this case, the PCR test, right? So what you're saying is that the COVID vaccines make equally sick people get a negative PCR test. That's literally what the definition of efficacy is, right? Yeah. This, it's not just the case control studies. This is how all the vaccine trials were designed as well. You got sick and thought you had COVID. You reported it. They said, okay, take that kit. You know, in a telemedicine conference, they said, take that kit we gave you at the beginning of the study. Swab your own nose, send it in to us. We'll test it. So, you know, 95% efficacious against what? Against someone thinking they had COVID, their doctor agreeing based on their symptoms, and they get a negative test. Right? So the whole definition of efficacy is a negative test despite being equally sick. That's the literal definition of efficacy. So I say to myself, surely there must be criticism of this design in the literature. So I go and I intend to learn more about it. And I find this review by Mark Lipitch, who's he's gotten very popular in the area of COVID vaccines because he's a major vaccine efficacy researcher. And he has this review that shows that 90% of vaccine efficacy studies since 1990s, basically. So they were invented in 1980 for the pneumococcal vaccine. And then over the last 10 or 20 years, they've become 90% of vaccine efficacy studies. And I'm looking at the table and I see these polio studies, and I'm looking at the table and I'm like, that makes it look like everyone was equally paralyzed and they defined the efficacy based on a negative stool test. I'm like, that can't be right. So I'm like, I cannot go and say this to the internet and not know for sure that they really fucked our knowledge up this much, right? Like, so I go and I pull up these four polio studies, and granted, this is not the polio vaccine that's used in the United States. This is the live polio vaccine that's used in the developing world, because they always give the dangerous vaccines to people in South Asia and Africa. Yeah. That's the MO, right? Is get it banned in the United States after you kill enough people, then give it to the Africans. Yeah. That's the MO. So I pull up these four polio vaccine studies, and that's exactly what they do. They have tens of thousands of people that are not just paralyzed children, but they are paralyzed with the literal specific clinical definition of polio, right? They have the specific nervous spinal degeneration that is by which polio is defined. But well, polio originally was defined based on that alone. Now it's defined as that plus a positive stool test for type 1 or type 3 wild poliovirus. Mm-hmm. So not type 2 poliovirus, which is the vaccine containing poliovirus. Mm-hmm. So these children have what used to be called polio and what is the clinical definition of polio, and are all paralyzed. And the vaccine is 95% effective against polio because it gives the paralyzed children a negative stool test for type 1 or type 3 wild poliovirus. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I spend like most of 2021 getting people saying like, oh, you're against the COVID vaccines. You want everyone to have polio too. And I'm like, what does COVID have to do with polio? And now I'm like, wait a second. COVID is exactly like polio because they define this vaccine that does nothing for the clinical case based on being equally sick with the problem and getting a negative test. And so why would you, as an industry, why would you all gravitate towards 90% use of a design that controls for the clinical case and defines efficacy based on the test for the pathogen of interest, unless you thought that your product was borderline useless or worse against the clinical case and was primarily useful for the test? Why else would you gravitate that? I mean, you would think what you would want to do is control for the pathogen and look at the clinical outcome, right? So when the CDC says that an mRNA booster shot is 95% effective against COVID-19 associated hospitalizations, this is a scam. Because every single person who hears this thinks, if I get COVID, I will stay out of the hospital. Mm-hmm. And what they mean is, if you're in the hospital with respiratory failure, you'll test negative for COVID. Right? So it's a complete sleight of hand where they know everyone who hears it thinks, you're controlling for COVID and the variable is hospitalization, but you're controlling for hospitalization. The variable is the COVID test.
So what year were these polio papers? They've been doing this forever. This is like the MO of their fraud vaccine research, right?
So I have an article called "Test Negative Case Control Studies Are a Scam." And it has those studies. So let me pull this up. So, all right, 2007, 2008, 2014, and 2012.
Did you send this to me or something?
Oh, no, but oh, okay. But I can.
I was going to say it probably won't work because I don't have access to the computer that you're on.
Oh, no, I just looked it up. So I Googled Master John test negative case control studies scan, and then it's top Google result.
Right here. Oh, got it.
Yeah. So if you scroll down, there's a bullet point list of four polio studies.
Here?
Those ones.
Oh, got it. Yeah. Okay. So I'm sorry, you might answer my question. So these were the original ones that you had saw, that you saw that the testing methods were.
Those were the four polio studies that I found when I said this can't be as bad as it
got
looks
it.
In this table.
Got it.
And then I looked it up and found that it's exactly as bad as it appears in the table.
One thing to comment on what you had said before, Ivan Illich in his book Medical Nemesis says exactly what you said about cleaning up the environment and doctors' efficaciousness being basically a complete illusion, like that. Like jumps in health of societies were always related to nutritional improvements or sanitation improvements or reductions in pollution or et cetera. So it's like that was such a huge thing for me. It's like, okay, if they really cared about the people, they'd start like cleaning up the environment. They'd start improving the food. They'd start removing these like toxic elements in the food supply. And because they want all of us to live, they want all of us to feel really good. And the fact that
that's why they want to mRNA vaccinate the food.
Yeah. We could talk about that too. Well, okay. So when did you catch wind of the mechanism of the vaccine? And I mean, well, what is your opinion on that? Getting the body to produce a toxic spike protein, is that a good idea or a bad idea?
It's a terrible idea. Although, you know, I think the average person can tolerate it. I mean, you know, I only probably the people that are dropping dead from it is 1 in 10,000 or something like that. You know,
So from what you've read, like that ability to produce that spike protein, do you think that would lead to a degenerative problem down the line? I mean, it's so recent, you know, like
it would do the opposite of what generating energy would do. So the spike protein is a pore forming toxin that pokes holes in cell membranes, and most energy is, or a major use of energy is putting things on one side or another of a membrane so that you can compartmentalize things, or you can use their distribution across those membranes as a future source of energy, or as some kind of signaling. And so, you know, if you had a disruption of mitochondrial energy production, one of the things that you're going to get is the inability to control your muscles, right? So you could have tremors or twitching, or, you know, any, depending on exactly what's impacted, you know, they could look like Parkinson's, or it could look like many other things. But anyway, you know, you poke holes in cell membranes, you're gonna get the same thing, because the problem is that your neurological regulation of your muscles is all driven by compartmentalizing calcium and other ions using energy. And if you poke holes in, you know, it's like, you're trying to carry water somewhere and you poke holes in the bucket. It's the same thing, right? Like, so you get a shitty bucket, or you poke holes in the bucket, you're in the same place, or, you know, or you have no energy to lift the bucket up. Like all three things result in the water not getting where you want it. Right. So it's very similar there. And I think one of the problems is the CDC and the FDA have what I view as a very bad system for trying to look for adverse effects, because I think medicine has this problem in general. They over believe in the specificity of causes and effects. So, you know, they think like, if you start from first principles and you say, okay, this thing's a pore forming toxin, it will eliminate the ion gradients across membranes and all the body. It will, you know, the spectrum of adverse effects you should expect from that is infinite. There's literally nothing in the body that could go wrong in the body that would not go wrong as a result of a disruption of cell membrane integrity or a disruption in energy production. Nothing. Well, you have this quote on the screen: what could be more important to understand than biological energy? Thought, growth, movement, every philosophical, practical issue involves the nature of biological energy. From Ray Pete, I wrote an article 2 days ago where I said, life centrally defined is the defiance of the imperative towards entropy as encoded in the second law of thermodynamics using the input of energy, right? Like that, just every single process in life is energy dependent, and there's no end to the list of secondary, tertiary, quaternary, and so on effects that would be downstream from a disruption of that. And even production of energy in, you know, just go to textbook mitochondrial function. It's all predicated on controlling the flow of ions across membranes in order to utilize the kinetic energy to synthesize ATP and then transfer that chemical energy elsewhere. And so there's a serious problem with dismissing everything that they don't say, well, this has a relation to what was discovered as a signal in a vaccine trial. They're just extremely narrowly looking at it. And I think it's just wildly plausible that any increased signal of any kind of health problem is very plausibly attributed to the vaccines. I think it's just completely unambiguous that this fivefold or whatever increase in athletes dropping dead in the field is just so obviously explainable by the vaccine. I mean, it doesn't mean you could prove that the vaccine did it. It just means that should be considered a major signal. Anything that the net increase in mortality that's occurring after the public health wiping out the mortality of the pandemic, yeah, it argues that the net effect of public health was to kill people. Something about public health is killing people. But anyway.
Just to go back a second. So you're saying the primary mechanism of the spike protein is for cells to accumulate intracellular calcium? Would that be the toxic effect?
That would be one of them, mm-hmm, but it's going to disrupt their control of any ions. So, mm-hmm, so certainly one of the things that they do is disrupt the control of calcium ions. And so in epithelial cells, that's going to cause, I mean, all the inflammatory cytokines do the same thing, but it's receptor mediated. Mm-hmm. You know, so histamine acts on an epithelial cell by binding to a receptor that allows calcium to come in, activate nitric oxide production, do some other downstream things, which ultimately leads to vasodilation when you have a little bit, or leads to epithelial permeability when you have a lot of it. And if you poke holes in the cell membrane, calcium is going to come in without a receptor activation. Mm-hmm. In the mitochondria, if calcium comes in, that's going to be a signal that will activate cell death, because the mitochondria is interpreting that as a sign that the rest of the cell is messed up. Mm-hmm. But there's all sorts of other ions. You know, on a nerve cell, if you allow chloride into the cell, you're going to inhibit it. But if you allow sodium or potassium into the cell, you're going to activate it. And you could just go on and on. There's many examples of this. Like in the gut, if you allow sodium to flow back into the cell by making it permeable, you're going to eliminate the sodium gradient that's used to transport glucose and a lot of different vitamins and some minerals. There's just endless examples of ion gradients being used to transport things or to signal things or to get things done.
What about, so, when you're hearing about the mechanism of this vaccine and knowing what you know, and Fauci saying things like, oh yeah, we tested it for 60 days. Did you think it was intent to hurt people, or was it just incompetence for money, or what did you start to think about?
I mean, I was dating someone at the time, and I actually drove her to the site to get her first vaccine. So I was, my position toward it at the time was, I already got COVID. Why would I get vaccinated? It was also sort of like all the arguments for vaccines are so sketchy, and I don't know what I think about them, that I will endlessly put off the need to think about it in the way that I do my tetanus shot. Mm-hmm. you know, like it was just like, I don't know if I want to get the vaccine, but I'd rather not have to think about it. And I don't have to think about it because I already got COVID. So, but you know, so I like, if knowing what I know now, back at that time, I would not have done that. I would have been like, you know, you can do whatever you want, but I'm not playing any part in this. Yeah.
I removed the gas from the car and I can't drive.
well, I don't know about where you come from, but in New York City, most girls don't drive.
Oh, got it.
They all talk about wanting to learn to drive and then drive. So anyway, I didn't, there was a lot to my evolution to thinking about arriving at what it might be doing. Even now, I'm not so sure that there are very many people who are consciously trying to hurt people. I mean, it would be bizarre if there weren't some, right? Because there's a certain percentage of psychopaths and sociopaths in the population, and it's completely irrational to think that people in power are unenriched in that fraction rather than enriched. I mean, that's just wildly irrational because if someone has malintent, then the only way on earth they could possibly not accumulate in positions of power is if malintent goes along with more than its proportional load of incompetence. And so you get these people who dismiss malintent using Hanlon's razor, which it would be very funny if Hanlon, no one knows who Hanlon is, but it would be very funny if he turned out to be malicious. But that's the idea that you should never ascribe to malice what can be ascribed to incompetence. But that even that is suggesting that there's generally a divergence between malice and incompetence. If there is, then it makes no sense to believe that the malicious people would be the most incompetent people on the planet. And we know that that's not true. I mean, if you look at serial killers or something like that, many of them are very competent at killing a lot of people before they get caught. Like there's nothing that makes malicious people obviously incompetent. So therefore, people in power, you know, like let's say you take two people in an election who are equally competent, but one's more malicious than the other, the malicious one is going to win, obviously, because they're going to play dirty, right? So it has to be the case that if you control for competence, malice accumulates in power. Because malicious people will seek power because they can exercise their malice with it. So they're more motivated to seek power and they're more they're generally going to be, even if they're equally personally competent, they will be more competent at getting power because by being malicious, they have a wider spectrum of tools in their kit that they can exercise to get that power. Whereas a person with integrity and non-malice will have ethical boundaries against using certain tactics, and that will put them at a universal disadvantage. So anyway, it must be the case that the percentage of people with malice, that the percentage of psychopaths and sociopaths who are in power has to be higher than the percentage in the general population. And I don't know what the numbers are off the top of my head, but we're in the single digit percents. We're not lower than that. Anyway, I still don't think that most of what's driving anything with the vaccine is outright malice. I don't think that the motivations are homogenous either. So I think people in Pfizer, you know, most of the people who work for Pfizer just want to have a good job and, you know, achieve something, like the people in R&D and whatever. And the CEO just wants to make the company make a lot of money. You know, I do think that there's evidence that they, you know, that they internally in their mind, they do things that they know are not quite the best and least malicious option, and they rationalize why they should do it anyway. I mean, why did the CEO of Pfizer sell 60% of his stock when the vaccine came out? Because he bought the rumor and sold the news, as they say in the trading circles. And he, you know, he expected something to look not as good as it seemed at first glance. And why do they use these studies? Because, you know, they learned they can game the system that way. But I don't think they're thinking about it. Like, I don't think Mark Lipich is sitting there going like, aha, test negative case control studies, we can scam everyone. It's just that these academics are so, they're so separated from the practical realities and so caught up in their academic ideas that they actually think it makes sense for the these, you know, 12 people in the world to be the, you know, among the 15 people that read each other's papers and endlessly write about how they targeted these specific pathogen of interest successfully, and it was a successful game. And so I really don't think that they want to increase the amount of paralysis in the world, but I do think that they're just the academics, you know, are very wrapped up in the academic question of, can we find a way to demonstrate the reduction of type 1 poliovirus in this sample population? And they're just totally out of touch with the reality of the parents who are going to be like, when is my kid going to be not paralyzed? Or, you know, they're right. So I don't, but there are probably some people who, I mean, there's definitely a camp of people who believe that there's too many people in the world and that they need to be somewhat surreptitious about how they fix that. You know, that's there. And then there's other people who just want a lot of power, and that's there. I mean, Bill Gates just strikes me as kind of like, he couldn't care less what he's monopolizing, but he has a voracious appetite to monopolize something. And since the federal government really did all they could to penalize him for monopolizing the software industry, he thought that he could, you know, revamp his reputation if he monopolized global public health. You know, he probably cares way more about that than overpopulation. You know, but all things being equal, if he could reduce the fertility rate by 10%, he'd probably do it. You know, he'd probably be like, well, here's a way we can prevent vaccine preventable diseases and also, you know, on the margins, cut down some fertility or whatever. I don't think I don't think he'd have ethical qualms about it.
What about the, as far as I know, this is true, but the pharma companies working with the Pentagon to create this vaccine, like nobody has, it's not an abstraction at all for anybody to believe that these neocon Pentagon types will go into the Middle East and lay waste to it. But they never think the same kind of malicious power could be turned on them. And so that also the fact that, like, how did they make so many vaccines so quickly? We never heard stories, or at least I didn't, of manufacturing plants, of producing these things at a rapid rate or whatever. It just seems absolutely crazy that people are on their fourth or fifth vaccine for like billions of people on the planet. It just seems like there had to have been some forethought about what the plan was and what to do about it. But I don't know. What do you think about
that? Well, there was definitely a lot of forethought. I would recommend Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s The Real Anthony Fauci. The last chapter of that book is called Germ Games. Mm-hmm. And I would, you know, if you don't have time, it's a big book. If you don't have time to read it, I would skip right to the last chapter and just read that. And it's a documentation of 20 years of pandemic preparedness planning that was taken out of the military's war game scenario planning from the post-World War II period. There was this guy, Peter Schwartz, who pioneered the use of the military scenario planning for oil companies in the 80s. And Schwartz is a futurist and scenario planner. He gave Senate testimony in, I believe, months before 9/11, that one possible terrorist attack would be two planes are driven into the World Trade Center. He sits on the advisory board to movies. So he was on Minority Report mm-hmm. as an advisor, which was about basically thought police who are able to predict crimes before they happen and mm-hmm. arrest you for them. And he was involved to some degree in scenario planning for the Rockefeller Foundation. In 2010, he was the main author of a report called Lockstep, where he plans out a pandemic that I haven't read the whole thing, but there's a quote from it that after the pandemic receded, the global leaders realized that the firmer grip on power that they had taken needed to be stepped up and centralized further rather than let go of it. And so they increased their authoritarianism because they realized that this was the mechanism by which they would solve poverty, inequity, and climate change. Mm-hmm. And that's like, you know, very, seems very prescient now. But anyway, the bulk of the scenario planning was Robert Kadlec was the major initiator of the, specifically of the German biological warfare scenario planning. He started it with Johns Hopkins, CIA was involved, and et cetera, in 1999. And fast forward to COVID, Trump appointed him Assistant Secretary of Preparedness and Emergency Response in 2017. So he was the inside head of COVID control in the U.S. when COVID happened. And he is also the guy who pioneered the scenario planning in 1999. So there were more than a dozen major multi-agency events, in some cases, multi-country events. And in 2019, there were two. Crimson Contagion was in June and Event 201 was in October. Mm-hmm. And these were very much, you know, how do we impose lockdown? How do we get people to accept the vaccine? Even modeling out like the vaccine hesitant people will be the African Americans and the natural health people and a growing online internet contingent who say that it wasn't tested for long enough to know it was safe. And they model out that it'll seem safe in the first year. And then after the first year, there will be a certain incidence of severe neurological problems tied to it, but there'll be low enough of a rate of those to marginalize those people. But the bigger problem will be that that data will come out saying that the CDC originally inflated the infection fatality rate. And so people will not want to take the vaccine because they don't think the disease matters. And here's how the FDA and the CDC can cooperate with the social media companies to make a new scare campaign to get people back thinking that they have to get vaccinated to get the rest of them. And, you know, you read this stuff and it's like, clearly they were working on it in an organized fashion. That doesn't mean that everyone has the same motivations in it. Okay. You know, I think the people in the CDC and FDA are thinking about things differently than Pfizer and thinking about things differently than, you know, Klaus Schwab and et cetera. And you can see that they're, you know, look at the top two people in the FDA. They resigned their in the FDA's vaccine section, the head of the vaccine stuff and the number two person who were in charge of approving the Pfizer vaccine or the EUA for the Pfizer vaccine. They resigned when the Biden administration took over because they said they were getting pressure to approve the boosters, and they didn't think they should have that level of political pressure on them. And they didn't know if the boosters were a good idea. They could see a lot of downsides to it. And they were even writing op-eds in the Wall Street Journal. Those people obviously had certain ethical boundaries that they felt were firmly violated by the political pressure on them. And yet these are the people that approve that, you know, gave the EUA and the consequent liability shield to the Pfizer vaccine on a test negative clinical trial design where everyone was equally sick and the vaccine did nothing to protect against sickness, but it gave them a negative test. Like, so all these things that I think are scammy, they clearly were not sitting there like, let's scam the public. Like, you know, they thought it was rational. They didn't see past how, you know, they didn't like see past their data model. And they obviously had serious ethical issues where their, you know, their sense was violated when they resigned. Right. So I think, I think people are very complex and they're, you know, differently attuned to the problems with data, and they come at the world thinking from different perspectives, and some of them are malicious. Most of them are not. That's how I see it.
What's that called? It's called cognitive capture, I think. Like, if you're part of some industry or something, you're eventually going to have to loosen up your morals to be part of something. Like I don't think you can be a very moral person and be like in the CIA. In fact, they'd probably select you to not be in the CIA if you are a humanist or something like that.
I don't think it would happen. I didn't know about that term, but it makes sense. And it reminds me of one time Noam Chomsky, who kind of went crazy with the COVID vaccine, but had been a very firm proponent of freedom of speech and so on before that. He was asked one time what he would do as president. And he said, the first thing that I would do is have myself arrested. And his point was that you can't really be the president of the US and not be involved in things that he would consider war crimes. Yeah. His point was that the institutions are kind of overpowering of the individuals in a similar way as you had just described. But I don't know. I think the CIA, have you ever seen the show Scandal?
I have not.
So the show Scandal is, it's made by Shonda Rhimes, who also, she made Grey's Anatomy and How to Get Away with Murder. And I think the CIA looks somewhat like Scandal. So the premise of Scandal is that there's the CIA, and then there's this guy who runs this cell within the CIA called B613, that its budget is designed so that it has no on-paper budget, but there's money that's like funneled into it. And the people who run the CIA don't know about it. And I think that's an underestimation of how it probably works. It's probably multiple cells like that who don't know about each other, or who do know about each other. And no, then there's like the people who run the CIA are probably not running the CIA, you know. Well, but
there's a book by Fletcher Prouty called The Secret Team, and he basically talks about the compartmentalization of the CIA being a key aspect of it. I think in the when was the CIA made it? 1947, I think. And he said two agents would be working with each other but have no clue who each other was, and they'd be reporting to the same person, but they wouldn't know. So, and they also said that they set up a mesh grid network in different institutions. And so say that they'd have somebody get hired by, I don't know, the head of the CDC or something, and they'd tell the director, this guy is a CIA agent. Then the director would leave, they get a new director, and then the new director wouldn't know that guy was a CIA agent. And so they did that across, I guess, everything. So they had a mesh network of just CIA agents. And I'm sure it's way more advanced now, but that was a long time ago.
I believe they testified to some degree about the principle in the church committee hearings in the 70s, because that's where the phrase plausible deniability comes from, which was, you design it so that I'm giving orders that I don't know are being carried out, and I didn't know that I gave them.
Yeah. In Douglas Valentine's book, the CIA as organized crime, he says the CIA will never engage in anything that they don't have plausible deniability. He said that was really important for them. Yeah. Yeah, man, I can't believe we've been talking for basically an hour. I can't even believe this. So one, do you have to go?
No, I got some time.
Okay, because we do have questions. I could continue talking to you about this, to be honest with you. Maybe we'll have to do a part two at some point. Maybe people, I think, would want us to talk about Ray Peet. So what, I mean, we talked about him a little bit earlier. Any thoughts on him passing away? Has he affected your point of view? You're a very smart guy. You have your own view of health and things like that, but did he affect you in any shape or form?
I always found Ray Peet to be an interesting source of alternative ideas, and he's definitely shaped my thoughts on some things. I mean, I never quite wholesale adopted his thoughts on any particular topic, but he was always thought-provoking with his work in a way that would make me research that topic. Probably the best example would be on the essential fatty acids. So I, you know, he motivated me to go back and read the original research on the essential fatty acids. And his position basically, there was one place at least where he said, maybe the essential fatty acids are essential, but if they are, it's at like 0.01 something percent of the diet.
Yeah.
And I came away with the belief that it's unambiguous that the essential fatty acids are essential, but if they're supplied with liver so that you have preformed arachidonic acid and you also have vitamin B6 and biotin and other factors that are needed in their metabolism, that it is about 0.12% of the diet that you would want as PUFAs. So I came away with it, away from it, believing that what's in the mainstream textbooks about needing gram quantities of linoleic acid is complete BS. And so I'm probably closer, especially on a practical dietary view, to where Ray Pete is than to where the textbooks are. Although I do believe that a lot of people have inadequate arachidonic acid activity as a result of various things that interfere with its utilization. So I think arachidonic acid is very important for preventing food intolerances and preventing chronic low-grade inflammation. And a lot of people who are using fish oil to antagonize it or NSAIDs to antagonize it. I guess another area where I might be somewhat sort of peat-ish is that I do think aspirin is uniquely more safe than all the other NSAIDs, although I'm not really like a everyone should take aspirin person at all. And I do worry about some of the effects of aspirin, but it's just from the perspective of proper utilization of arachidonic acid and DHA, which I do think are essential, or aspirin is less harmful than the other NSAIDs are. But, you know, I don't know, on carbon dioxide, I don't know that I'm exactly where Pete is, but I think it was his influence that originally got me to think more about carbon dioxide and the impact of diet on it. And I used to teach classes at Brooklyn College where I would use diet's impact on carbon dioxide as a central organizing principle for some of the lectures, really relating to biochemistry. Although, you know, I'm probably not as enamored with CO2 as many of the people who are asking questions that I saw.
You're not sitting in a bag of CO2 right now, Chris.
No, I guess my criticism of Pete's work would be that I think he tends to think in black, or at least speak in black and white terms. And I think there's a lot of, I'm the nuanced guy. And so I think the reason Pete liked my work is because some of the things that the mainstream demonizes, because I'm the nuanced guy, say, hey, wait, you can't demonize cholesterol or something like that. And so the people who like cholesterol get on board with me, you know, whereas I'm coming from it less from a cholesterol's the good guy, estrogen's the bad guy perspective, and more of a, you know, you really shouldn't demonize molecules. They're just molecules. That's I'm more from that perspective. And so I think, I as an example, I often got the impression from reading Pete that he believed the optimal amount of stress would be zero if you could somehow get there. And I think that's just obviously not true. I don't know that he ever said that, but it's just the way he talks about stress gives you the impression that he assumes that underneath what he's saying.
I'd push back on that a little bit. Like Hans Selye, he said the only people that are free from stress are dead. And there, it was never the point to try to mitigate all. Like he said, anticipating a loved one getting home could be stressful. And so I think,
Who said that? Selye or
yeah, in stress without distress. But I think Pete's idea was that like you and I couldn't escape stress if we tried, you know, like we're talking right now being irradiated by cell phone towers and I'm in a EMF hell in this little box. And that's a type of stress on ourselves or the things that happen to us in youth or school experience or family experiences or eating. I can't believe it's not butter growing up. Like it's impossible to escape the clutches of stress. And so as far as I could tell, that was never the goal to like live in a bubble or something like that.
No, I'm not saying that Pete ever suggested that the optimal amount of stress was zero. It just, the way that he speaks, I think some perhaps gives the impression that he is making black and white, good, bad comparisons, perhaps even more than he believes. And it comes across to me as if he never said that. He certainly never said that, but you know, he's made statements like, the reason we use coconut oil is because it's not possible to find something that has less essential fatty acids in it than that doesn't have some other problem with it, right? Like, so it does feel like, yes, he acknowledges that there's no way to have no estrogen, but sometimes I get the sense that he's saying, like, okay, I concede that I can't have zero estrogen, but here's how I could get as close as possible. You're way more, you know, I haven't been anywhere near as deep in his work than you are. So I will defer to you for any nuances on his work. But I'm just saying, like, if I had a place to disagree with him, it would probably be on, I would probably want to add a lot more nuance to certain topics as I see them in those areas.
I feel you. One thing on, so I can't remember when I was talking to him, but so again, this might be an answer that's 45 minutes, but the DHEA or arachidonic acid, but more specifically DHA, because that's a precursor to lipid peroxidation, or it's a, from what I understand, a big promoter of it. What did that mean? Like, there had to be some, if they were essential, they had to be some level of like desirable lipid peroxidation in the body. Like, and wouldn't nobody agree that that would be a good thing?
I don't know that I caught that. Wouldn't nobody agree that there is some minimal amount of peroxidation that you want under what circumstances?
Okay, so is lipid peroxidation, that's a bad thing, right? It harms mitochondria. It's damaging to cell.
I think, you know, I think that like technically you have peroxides formed enzymatically in the enzymatic reactions that you would separate from uncontrolled lipid peroxidation. I mean, usually when someone refers to lipid peroxidation, they're talking about random spontaneous lipid peroxidation in the cell membrane that has the possibility of a lipid peroxidation chain reaction, which would destroy the cell membrane. And they're not talking about like what might literally be peroxides formed enzymatically in a pathway when they say that. It's sort of like the way when people talk about ketones, they're not talking about fructose, even though fructose is a ketone, and they are talking about beta hydroxybutyrate, even though beta hydroxybutyrate is not a ketone.
Alcohol. Oh, okay. So I guess I was talking with him and I was like, Ray, is it the fact that they're harmful? Like they're a precursor to this harmful event. Like, wouldn't that mean that it was just not really a necessary thing in a cell? Again, I know I'm looking at this very simplistically, but he was like, yeah, that's why I think they're not essential, because they're the precursors to lipid peroxidation. Or a cell can't be so susceptible to lipid peroxidation when DHA isn't around.
Well, I will say that it's very hard to produce a deficiency of DHA without feeding excess linoleate. But I think the science is pretty clear that what happens in what is considered a DHA deficiency is a deficiency of DHA. So if you go back to the original experiments of Burr and Burr, those showed that there was a clinical deficiency syndrome that occurred in the absence of any omega-6 fatty acids, and that omega-3 could mitigate some of the symptoms, but it made others worse. And for decades after that, no one thought that omega-3s were essential. And whenever someone talked about essential fatty acids, they meant omega-6. And that changed in the 70s, I believe it was, when there was a girl with, well, what happened was Ralph Holman, who was the graduate student of Burr, had, he's the guy who got the Army to start including Spam in their Army diets. And he also got the FDA to approve the addition of fat to total parenteral nutrition, or TPN, which is intravenous food. The reason that originally TPN didn't have any fat was that they did experiments with dogs and it gave them fatty liver. The reason it gave the dogs fatty liver is because there was no choline in it, and you need choline to export fat from the liver. And they didn't figure that out until like 50 years later. Mm-hmm. So they have no fat. Then it turns out that people on TPN get eczema. And so Ralph Holman petitions the FDA, and he's like, these people are getting eczema because they have no fat in the TPN. So they add fat. And so they had two different fats. One was soybean oil, which has a reasonable balance of omega-6 and omega-3. And the other was safflower oil. Safflower oil had an omega 6 to 3 ratio of 140 to 1. So it basically had no, you know, completely trivial amount of omega 3. And so on the TPN, the only fatty acids are the linoleic acid and linolenic acid. And there's no arachidonic acid, no DHA. And so any DHA would be formed from enzymatic conversion of alpha linolenic acid into DHA. And so what happens if you have the preformed fatty acids in the diet, it doesn't really matter because they can just get incorporated without any of the enzymatic conversion. But if those are your only fatty acids, then you have to do the enzymatic conversion. And then all of a sudden the ratio becomes very relevant because they use the same enzyme. So if you have 140 times more omega-6 than 3, then all the omega-6 is gonna go through that pathway and crowd out the little omega-3. And so what happened was she started seeing double and had all kinds of neurological problems when she was on the safflower oil diet. They switched her back to the soybean oil and it went away. And that was the initiating event into research on the role of DHA in the nervous system. And subsequent experiments with monkeys showed that you could reproduce some of these neurological problems, especially problems with visual acuity and mental processing, by depleting their brain DHA. And the way that you have to deplete their brain DHA that much is to feed linoleic acid. But what happens is the brain becomes dominated by an abnormal omega-6 fatty acid of 22 carbons that's not usually present in place of the DHA. And I think it would be very hard to blame this on lipid peroxidation from the linoleate, because you are getting highly polyunsaturated 22 carbon fatty acids filling up the exact same volume in the brain. It's just that you are not getting any DHA. And then of course there's numerous cellular experiments and other things used to try to explain that. But the end result is that you can produce a very specific neurological syndrome from DHA deficiency that you can't get if you just feed linoleate. Like if you have to feed linoleate in conjunction with a very low omega-3 intake, zero preformed DHA during a certain window of life where the diet highly enriches the brain in order to get that. So I think it's very clear that it's not a non-specific result of linoleate feeding. If you feed a lot of linoleate in a way that doesn't deplete the brain DHA, you're going to have a bunch of problems, but you're not going to get the specific results that you get from a DHA deficiency. The other thing you have to keep in mind is that if you look at how tightly the fatty acids are regulated, the brain regulates their concentration extremely tightly, way tighter than any other tissue does, right? And so you're not proving anything, but as detective work, if something is very tightly regulated, you assume there's a reason for it. right? And so it is rational to look at that and say, if the brain, no matter what you eat, will put X amount of DHA, practically no EPA, practically no alpha-linolenate, practically none of this other stuff, just a lot of arachidonic acid and a lot of DHA, that looks like there's something very important about those two fatty acids being present in the brain. And the fact that it is extremely hard to produce a deficiency of DHA in the brain means two things. On a practical level, you're probably not going to get one, but you know, on an academic level, it's hard to argue that there's not some reason for it when you really have to try so hard to try to override the brain's natural regulation to make it be there.
Yeah, fair enough. I've always thought this was like an academic argument. You know, if you eat an egg or you eat oysters, you're going to get some level of these. And so I really always left that stuff up to Ray. I never got too deeply into it. I remember you sent me Precious Yet Perilous like 10 years ago. And you're like, Danny, you really should read this.
Anyway. I do think it has practical aspects because there are conditions where you could have depletion of DHA for other reasons. And, you know, as an example, you were talking about lipid peroxidation. So one of the things that lipid peroxidation does is create a lot of harmful stuff, but another thing it does is deplete those fatty acids in the brain. So I do think it's plausible that there are, people who have neurological problems because of the lipid peroxidation in the brain, and that part of the result, part of the causation, is a depletion of brain DHA. And I also think that just in general, people are relatively suboptimal in DHA in the modern context because the omega-6 to omega-3 ratios are so thrown off. So I think people that don't eat any seafood and whose only eggs are, you know, commercial eggs, and who are otherwise $10 vegetable oils,
$10 eggs, New York eggs, $10 New York eggs. I think
the crap eggs are only like $5. But
no, yeah, never mind. Keep going. Sorry, bad joke.
I think I said most of it. So like, I do think that in general, because. Well, look, some people love seafood, and I'm not talking about those people, but people who eat zero seafood and who a lot of people don't eat a lot of eggs anyway. You know, some people just don't eat eggs much. Some people don't eat eggs that often. And most people eat eggs that don't have much omega-3, and people are eating a lot of omega-6 laden vegetable oil. And so I do think that there's probably a general suboptimal DHA level in people's membranes. I'm like, Pete probably wouldn't have agreed with that. And, you know, but I think most people would, there's a lot of other reasons why it would be good for people to eat pastured eggs and to include some seafood in their diet. And I, you know, if you acknowledge that point, it becomes academic, but that is a practical point. Like, some people don't eat seafood or eggs, mm-hmm. You know?
I feel you. I could talk more about this. Why don't we, the last thing, we're going like one, last 7 minutes or so. What do you think? I mean, going back to the COVID vaccine stuff, do you think this is over? Do you see stuff on the horizon? I was making a joke about the inflation. Somebody made a TikTok video about the food inflation in New York, and it was astronomical. It was absolutely insane. It was like $10, like shitty eggs. It was like $14.99 Jimmy Dean sausages. It was Reese's cups for like $8 or something. And so it seems like what started as overprinting money for handouts and things, and the virus has now morphed into crazy inflation and a looming financial system shift over. So,
how do you tie that to the vaccine?
Say it again.
How are you tying that to the vaccine?
Well, the telling everybody to go home, printing out, printing money. The vaccine was a solution to the pandemic. I'm not saying that inflation is related to the vaccine per se, but it's all one big phenomena of, I don't know. Do you think, Crimson can, no, not that, catastrophic contagion. Have you heard about that?
No.
That, so that's a new event 201 that just happened with the CIA and Bill Gates. And this time they...
Wait, this was post-COVID?
Yeah, this happened in October, or I'm sorry, maybe November 2022. So they just did another one. And this new simulation was about a virus that allegedly specifically targeted children. So you can see how this would play out if something happened like this.
I think I heard some stuff about that, but I didn't follow up on it and I didn't know the name of it. I think they're going to go back into hiding for about 10 years at least. And I do think there's a very deep relationship to the inflation. So first of all, I will say that the price of my eggs didn't really change, although I subscribed to a farm CSA with a regenerative farm upstate. So I was actually paying a flat fee for all my food, but I think the inflation was higher in crap food compared to food from regenerative farms because of the lower fossil fuel and chemical fertilizer inputs. Mm-hmm. But anyway, here's how I see it connected to the inflation. So I am 50-50 tied between what I originally thought, which is that the Federal Reserve is so scared of having let the inflation genie out of the bottle that they will accidentally completely undermine the entire global public health authoritarianism. I'm tied 50-50 between that and what this fellow named Tom Luongo believes, which is that Jerome Powell and Jamie Dimon and some of the other New York bank CEOs are fighting a war against the American Democrats, the World Economic Forum, the European Union, and so on, and that they will deliberately undermine this whole thing. But regardless of which of those two things is true, I think one of them has to be true. And that's because everything that they did in 2020 was only able to be done in America because they paid everyone a 30% raise above their salary to stay home and do nothing. There's no way they could have gotten away with locking down in the way that they did without that. Also, when they introduced the vaccine mandates for the workers, this was at a time where corporations were drowning in the cash that they had created. The Federal Reserve has been they've been monetarily tightening all of last year, and that money is just going away. I think it's quite possible that if no one stops him, that Powell is going to rewind monetary inflation at least back to 1987 and possibly back to 1971. We'll have to see how it goes. But right now, all the big corporations that were the primary beneficiaries of that money are now starting major layoffs. And there's no way on earth that they're going to have the same tolerance for being told that they have to fire people irregardless of their skill and contribution to the company based on their vaccine status when they are now very worried about their bottom line. They had no worry about their bottom line because they were drowning in cash that had been created at that time. Most of the vaccine mandates are disappearing. They're being struck down in court. They're being withdrawn out of embarrassment. It's not universal across the world, but I think that the vaccine mandate bubble is popping in the same way that the stock market bubble is popping, same way that the Bitcoin bubble popped, et cetera. And I think that if there's a lot of people in the investment community who think that this is all coming to an end and the Fed's going to turn around. I think both on a fundamental level, they can't, because if you look at any time in history where we had the degree of inflation that we had, there was always a double peak of inflation after it. And I think they're hellbent on not repeating the same mistake in the 70s of thinking that it was over and then having it come back even worse after that. And if it's possible that they are playing some sort of 3D chess against Gates and Klaus, then there's all the more reason to believe that they're not turning around anytime soon. But I just think even if you just take the sort of like surface interpretation of what they say they're doing, I think they can't turn around soon. I think we're going to be in a very slow moving recession that's going to hit maximum pain at the end of next year. I think we're going to be in a permanent, not permanent. I think we're going to be in a very long-term place of relative fiscal austerity compared to the last couple of years. I think politically, the fact that the Republicans took over the House has already guaranteed that the Democrats are, you know, Biden's the lame duck president for the next 2 years. The fact that the 20 MAGA fanatics stood out approving the speaker, they actually won some pretty serious concessions. So they need a 3/5 vote for any tax increases, for example. So I think there is. And also, if I'm right that there's going to be a recession with Max Payne at the end of 2024, that guarantees that the Republican is going to win against Biden, because no incumbent ever wins in a recession year. So I think all things point towards a largely Fed imposed, but also politically constrained period of at least 6 years of relative fiscal austerity. Europe is going to try to hold out, but Europe is being forced into a problem where they are they're basically on the Fed has them on two legs trying to you know, like this, right? Yeah, where they're trying to straddle restricting their money supply to keep up with the Fed so that the euro doesn't lose all its value relative to the dollar. But what happens when you contract money is that the interest rate spreads between high risk and low risk credit blow out. So what that means is when money's gushing everywhere, you can give a loan to anyone. It doesn't matter. That's why we have like subprime housing crisis back in 2008 and so on. But when money's not gushing anywhere, the people who lend it say, wait a second, are you going to pay me back? And so if Europe contracts money in the way that the US is contracting money, that means that they have to deal with the credit, the interest rates between high-risk countries like Italy and low-risk countries like Germany spreading apart. And so they're basically have, you know, two legs on either side of trying to stabilize the currency or trying to keep the European Union together. So I think everything's just going to fall like dominoes over the course of several years into political austerity. And there's going to be a massive shift away from the Canada CIA American Democratic Party in this current era. It's odd to put those two things like just straight up together, but that's what they are now. And so I think we're in a period where there's just no money to fund lockdowns, no money to fund vaccine mandates, no money to fund any of this, no money to fund Bill Gates's global police. So I think he's just, and also, I don't think Bill Gates was ever the most powerful person in the world. And I think he had his day in the sun. And now, you know, he's probably there as soon as he's not advantageous to the greater centralization of world power, they're just going to not really care about him. And he's going to be like, pandemic number two, I don't know what's happening. And they're going to be like, yeah, whatever, we've moved on. If you look at none of this, once I was like clued into what they were doing, none of it surprised me at all, because I was paying attention back in 2008 when they started when Obama got elected in 2009, they started militarizing all the federal agencies. And the libertarians were the only ones paying attention to it. They were like, why does the post office need tanks and whatever? This is a waste of money. But if you drank raw milk in 2008 or 2009, you saw what happened when the feds raided Rossum with their guns drawn and like willing, ready to shoot people to confiscate all their raw milk and all this stuff. And, you know, Agnes Vonderplanitz, who pioneered the cow share program, which became a legal success. He moved to Thailand believing that the American government was out to kill him. And then he, almost died when his brakes were cut. And then he did die after he leaned on a balcony at his apartment and it happened to be broken. And so he fell right then. Then he played a role in his death by denying surgery at the hospital or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they, at that time, apart from like raiding people's houses over their jelly not being approved, you know, with guns and military boots and camouflage pants and like locking down their house with US Public Health Service, apart from that stuff, that was, I was living in Massachusetts at that time, and they passed forced quarantining laws. And that was when Verichip made the first implantable microchips for several purposes in humans. One was GPS technology, one was carrier medical and dental records. But swine flu, they really wanted swine flu to kill people, and it was a dud. Mm-hmm. And Verichip had made a chip that could, that where the cops could scan you on the street and know whether you'd been vaccinated and whether you'd been infected. And they could use that as a basis to throw you in a quarantine camp. You know, so what did they do when swine flu was a dud? They went back into hiding. They were also doing the national animal identification system, where they wanted every single farm animal in the country to have either an implantable or hang from their ear an RFID chip where they could trace them all. Like all these things just revealed what they were trying to do. And then they rolled back and we didn't hear from again for 10 years. And I think they're going to do the same thing. So we would be very unwise if we don't use the 10 years that we're going to have to make sure this doesn't happen again and to run these people out of town, you know. But I think we do have at least 6, if not 10 years of time before we have some greater threat to our freedom coming.
Much more optimistic than I am. That's good to hear. Okay, Chris,
a lot of my friends tell me I'm an optimist, and they scratch their head and they're like, "What?"
Okay, Chris, let everybody know how they can support you. So, is chrismasterjohnphd.substack? Is that the major source?
Yeah. My main place is Substack. So, chrismasterjohnphd.substack.com. That's where I put my newsletter, and that's in the menu. You can find my eBooks, and you can subscribe to my membership program and get monthly Q&As and premium content and all that stuff.
So everything through Substack.
Yeah. Yeah. Like up in the menu there's the eBooks and all that other stuff.
Dude, amazing. Hey, thank you so much for joining me today. I really apologize about the tech errors. It was super,
no worries.
It was 11 years in the making. I really appreciate you, Chris. I always appreciate awesome. Your point of view and just, really explaining things in a lot of detail. So I'm honored to have you on. I really appreciate it. And we'll have to do a part two because we didn't get to any of these questions.
All right. Sounds good, man.
Okay, brother. Great stay on the line. And thank you so much. Really appreciate it.